It's such a friendly place.
And today's Focus programme is introduced by Jules Alderson.
Thank you so much for joining us at Hospital Radio today.
Thank you for having me. No, it's been really good to look around and see your studio. Very impressive.
We're here to talk about the Norwich Astronomical Society. Could you introduce yourself and tell us what your role is for the society, please?
Okay, my name's Stephen Chambers. I've been a member of the society for probably about 25 years or so, kind of off and on a little bit. Currently, I'm really just a member there, though I am also on the committee, mainly just as a member of the society.
How did you first get interested in astronomy?
I think the same way as a lot of people my kind of age did. So I guess I grew up in about the 70s. Patrick Moore was very significant on telly at the time. So that's probably one of the ways in. Then I know my parents, kind of after seeing Sky at Night, we'd quite often go out and we'd see if we could see the same things they were talking about. And I do also remember a trip over to Norwich Astronomical Society, been in late 70s, I guess. And we looked at things like Saturn and Jupiter through the telescopes there. So that was kind of the introduction to astronomy. And I guess it's the same way with a lot of people. You start off with an interest in childhood, and then it kind of wanes a bit while family life and that takes over in kind of middle life. And then as you get a little bit older, you get a little bit more free time, and it's a really enjoyable hobby to get into.
What do you do as a member or a volunteer with the society?
As a member, the society really is a club, a place where the members of the club can get together. We have a shared interest in astronomy, so there's lots to talk about. It's also a case of the equipment at the Astronomical Society is probably better than anything any of us have got at home, so it's good to go out there and use some more sophisticated equipment. It's kind of an enjoyable way of getting together with people that share an interest. I guess the other inside of it is there is, as part of the Society's remit, there is an outreach element to it, which is also really enjoyable. So we put on public talks, there's also talks for members, particularly when we're inviting members of the public to the sites. Then there's obviously lots of roles to do there in terms of just making sure people are safe and know what they're doing on site. And then also introducing them to astronomy, so we'll always have plenty of telescopes available. It's another really enjoyable part of being a member of Norwich Astronomical.
Does the Society have a particular mission in mind?
As being part of a charity, it's important that we have this outreach element to what we do. And I don't know if it's really configured down in what the mission should be, but certainly introducing people to astronomy is part of that. And I think it's then up to people, if they come along and they see some stars and see some planets, and really what they then go on and do, it might be a case of that's not for them, or if it's something that's interesting, then I think it's a useful place for people to explore astronomy. And it can be quite an intimidating kind of hobby in some ways, whereas I think a lot of people trying to get into astronomy maybe on their own will find telescopes quite difficult to use and not really know if they're looking at the right thing in the sky. Whereas as part of a group, then it's a bit more supportive, and I guess we're able to show people what is in the sky, what sorts of things we're looking at, and kind of show them the things that are interesting. It's one of those things that I think a lot of modern telescopes, they all come with computers nowadays embedded in them, so quite often they'll find their own object, but often a case of you're not really, you look through the eyepiece and there isn't anything really there, because you'd need a much bigger telescope possibly to see, or much darker sight. So it's quite useful to actually be able to see, have information on what sort of objects that particular telescope would be useful to look at, and what conditions you're observing, sight you're looking from, will allow you to see. Otherwise it can be a little bit disheartening just running through all these catalogue of objects that could be visible but are not really. So yes, so it's one of the things, we kind of is sharing a hobby and sharing what's interesting in the hobby.
I read on your website when I was preparing for this conversation about your one of the domes with the telescope in it,
yeah,
that has the kind of the computer in it that can find the things for you. I was really fascinated by that. Could you tell me more about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not as clever as it sounds in the first instance. So if we're looking maybe, well, it could be something as simple as the moon. Now, things you all know where the moon is because it's the big bright object in the sky. So it's not complicated to point a telescope at the moon. But if you're pointing at something like a faint cluster of stars that you couldn't see visually, then to actually aim, there's a number of ways which you could then try and point at yourself. But if you've just got a little handset and you can select the name of the object you're trying to get to, and it'll then move the telescope itself. Normally they look fairly close to the object they're trying to look at. That takes one element of trying to find the object away. There is also another group of people who will gain a lot of satisfaction from knowing the sky well enough to actually use telescopes manually and to be able to push them around to actually find those objects. And there's a technique we call star hopping. So you go from one bright star to a slightly fainter star to a fainter star and then find the object you're trying to get to. And that's a skill. It's rewarding to learn it. But you don't have to. There's many, many telescopes nowadays will come with computer pointing.
Wow, I had no idea such a thing existed, but I can imagine that can really help people when they first get started, to give them, as you were saying, a chance to actually get into it before getting really frustrated.
Now, I think that's absolutely right. You just got to know the object you're going to ultimately get to is something that will be roughly what the expectation is when you get there. Because if it's a very, very faint galaxy, it's a long way away, it's not going to be very impressive, even if the telescope will find it. Whereas if you find these bright globular clusters, M13 is an example, it'll be stunning in pretty much any telescope. Some telescopes will have 20,000 objects that they can go to. Trouble is probably 19,500 will be pretty much invisible.
How big is this telescope to be able to find such a huge catalogue?
Yeah, that's the other thing. So telescopes don't have to be particularly big. Society's, the largest aperture telescope we've got at the Society is currently a 16 inch in the main dome. So the primary mirror is 16 inches in diameter. And the reason why you have big telescopes here, or big aperture telescopes, is the amount of light is collecting. Yeah, if you just look at the sky, your eye determines how much light you're collecting, so your pupil of your eye dilates about 1 centimetre across. So if you compare that with the area that you can collect photons from something at 16 inches in diameter, you're much, much more light you're collecting, so you should be able to see a lot fainter objects. So it's usually when we're looking at telescopes, we're not looking at magnification, we're looking at collecting as much light so we can see faint objects.
The Society's based in Seething.
Yeah.
Is that a good location? Just thinking about bright lights from a city probably not being helpful.
It's better than its previous location. Now, I don't know if you realise, but the observatory has got strong links with this hospital. I think it's the early 1990s. The NHS was looking to resite the hospital from St Stephen's somewhere else. And this was highlighted as one of the potential sites. And one of the potential objectors was Seething Observatory, which had a site on Coney Lane. It moved a couple of times before, so we kept moving to the outskirts of the city to avoid light pollution. And of course, if they put this site just the other side of Coney Lane, that was going to rather destroy what we could see. NHS provided us with the site down at Seething, and it also provided the money to build the clubhouse. So if you go down there, there is quite a substantial and quite a nice clubhouse down there. It's brick built, it's quite warm, we can seat 30 or 40 people in for a lecture at a time. So it was a nice facility, and it's far enough outside of Norwich that there's pretty dark skies down there.
The sky, I imagine, and what you can see changes throughout the year. Could you give us an idea of what you might be able to see in the spring or summer?
It's an interesting time of a year, because obviously the days are getting shorter. No, they're not. They're the other way around, isn't it? The days are getting longer. The nights are getting shorter. So at this time, what you can see is you can still see some of the winter constellations, and you can start to see some of the summer constellations. So it looks, maybe start off with some of the ones that are in the west. So these are the ones that have been around with us for most of the winter. Jupiter is really high in the sky at the moment. So if you look to just to the west of south, fairly high in the sky, the brightest object in the sky is Jupiter. And that's quite impressive to see that. If you've got a telescope, it's even more impressive to see it. Binoculars, I can't, but some people will be able to see the moons of Jupiter in the binoculars. If you try it and don't see them, then you're with me. My eyes are not good enough to resolve it. If you come straight down from Jupiter, it's quite interesting. You've also got the brightest star in the sky. So Jupiter's the planet. You come straight down, you'll see just above the horizon is Cirrus at the moment. That's the brightest star we've got to us. And one of the ways people say you can tell the difference between planets and stars is stars twinkle. Don't know if you heard that.
No, I haven't.
Okay, so I believe that's true. But it's a good one. If anybody's out there, you can test it out, because you've got the brightest planet and the brightest star sort of one above each other. So you should see Sirius at the bottom. It's well known for twinkling, having lots of different colours, so you might see it change colour, especially if it's quite a windy day. You'll see it twinkling quite strongly, whereas Jupiter should be static and not twinkling.
And then thinking about as we move into the summer.
Yeah, so at the moment it's really early hours of the morning, or certainly past midnight. You start to see the summer triangle of stars start to appear, and something that Patrick Moore really promoted as a way of navigating your way around the summer sky. So if you get used to seeing the summer triangle, that's really a good, useful kind of signpost for different objects around. So it's made up of stars Deneb, Altair and Vega, and the Milky Way runs through it. So as you go on through the summer months, seeing it, you should also be able to make out the Milky Way if you're somewhere dark. If you've got binoculars and telescopes, there's a number of interesting objects. There's Ring Nebula near Vega, and you've got star clouds in Cygnus region. So there's lots of things you can see. Dark nebula as well in that region. More and more involved in astronomy.
What's a dark nebula?
I slipped that one in, didn't I, really? If you see the Milky Way, I don't know if you're familiar with the Milky Way.
Not massively. As a concept, I can imagine what you're talking about.
If you see it visually, it's kind of, it is as the name, it's kind of this milky patch in the sky that runs along. So it's a long, thin, thinnish stream. And at certain points, it will kind of seem broken, or there's darker areas. Typically, you have to be somewhere fairly dark, out in the countryside, to really see these areas, which we call dark nebula. And they're dust in front of the Milky Way, so it more kind of blocks the light of the Milky Way. And they're quite interesting shapes, and it gives the Milky Way itself a bit more structure when you look at it. You can see different areas of it, and there's different bits that are brighter and different areas that are darker because they've got these bits of gas and dust in front of them.
Interesting.
Do things like satellites interfere with what you can see?
Again, that's a really poignant question at the moment. I think it's really annoying some of the professional astronomers, maybe a little bit. I'm sure there's some amateurs also getting quite annoyed by the fact they're seeing so many satellites nowadays. There was a real worry about when the first Starlink satellites went up that was really going to ruin amateur astronomy. I haven't seen it really ruining amateur astronomy in that kind of way. And it's also quite interesting. There's a website called Heavens Above, which, well, you can put in your location and it'll give little star maps of predicted satellites and trails and what satellites were. So it might be a part of an old rocket booster or something going across there. And it's quite a pleasant thing to do in the summer months. If you print out a few of these, that'll tell you down to the second where these satellites are going to be. So nice relaxing sit outside, maybe have a drink, and then a pair of binoculars you can, with a group of friends, see who's going to be the first person to spot whichever piece of old Soyuz space junk is circling over us.
So we've already discovered what a dark nebula is. Have you got any other kind of fun facts, things about the night sky that people might not know, which are quite fun and might encourage people to give it a go?
There's a lot you can kind of see in the sky that will tell us a lot about the universe and cosmos. So I think astronomy was one of the first of the sciences. So, and it was a very much an observing kind of science. So it's a way of getting in, even as amateurs, and seeing the first kind of ideas of how we start to understand the world around us. And one of the sorts of things you can look at is colours of stars. One typical one is in Orion, which is currently in the west. Some people may know the belt stars of Orion. But if you look at two on the corners of the Orion, the shoulders and on the knees of Orion, you've got two stars that are very different colours. You've got Betelgeuse. One's Betelgeuse, a very, very red star. So it's come to the end of its life and it'll eventually run out of fuel. But as stars get older, they tend to get more and more into the orange and red spectrum. And as they're very young, they tend to burn very hot, very blue. Little things you can look at and see these kind of stars. You can look at the Pleiades now. Actually, if you're looking at areas, so near the belt stars of Orion, there's a fuzzy patch. If you have a pair of binoculars, look at this fuzzy patch just below the belt stars of Orion. That's an area which stars are forming in at the moment, and you don't really see the new stars forming as much as the gas that's surrounding them, they're forming from, is starting to light up. That's something you can see really quite easily in binoculars if you look there. Then if you go across a little bit higher and up to the west, you see the Pleiades. So this is the Seven Sisters constellation. And that's what would have happened within the Orion Nebula, but again, a few million years further on. And there you see the stars as the main thing. If you take really long exposure pictures of it, you can still see some of the traces of gas that they were formed from. But again, it's kind of as the universe is evolving, new stars are being generated, and then you can kind of see as they develop. And then in Taurus, there's a much bigger cluster as these stars are now starting to drift apart from each other. So they all originated in the same place, and they start to fill the Milky Way more with stars. So it's interesting. It's a changing, dynamic place, though not in our lifetimes. It's static within our lifetimes, but it is ever-changing.
You mentioned a moment ago that the Society has events that people can come along to.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about any of those?
Yeah, we do two types of talks. So there's the public talks, which don't really expect any prior knowledge of anything. And there's a slightly more advanced set of talks, which will be members' talks. And that's one of those things that the only thing we like to try and learn as much as we can about the whole universe. But the only way, we can't go and touch it, we can't go and don't give it a sniff or listen to it or anything. The only thing we can do really is look at the photons, look at the light we're receiving from it. And then colour is a really big clue of what's really happening. So yeah, it's colour of stars, quite an important clue as to what all these objects are in the universe.
Yeah. I was just curious about the different stars that you can see in the northern...
I was lucky enough about 10 years ago to go to Australia, and it's such a weird thing to do, to look at the sky from Australia. Everything's backwards and upside down. Orion is upside down. Things tend to look as though they're going in the opposite direction to what you expect them to go into. It is very... From somebody who's been used to looking at the sky to seeing the sky in Australia, it was very confusing. So some things you can see from both hemispheres. So Orion's a good example, because it's really quite low down south in our skies here, is also quite high in the north if you get to the southern hemisphere. So it's not a case of everything suddenly switches at some time. But yes, there's stars you can see in the southern hemisphere if you're in the southern hemisphere that you can never see from the northern hemisphere. And one of the complexities, one of the things we've got that are really nice in the northern hemisphere is we've got the North Star, and that's really helpful for navigation and also just for us finding our way around the sky. But in the southern hemisphere, there's no south star. So there's a constellation that's kind of used, and then you track back a number of star diameters from it or something. So it's a lot more complicated in the southern hemisphere to know where the south celestial pole is. So, yeah, there is complexity. If you were going to go and try and map the world, you almost need to map the sky before you map the world.
I guess astronomy has been an important subject for such a long time.
It was, sorry, one of the first sciences really get going. The whole navigation side of it really pushed it on yet further again. So I think whenever anybody tried to navigate and understand, you know, where they were on the world, being able to have these pointers in the sky that didn't change, and you could, they were constant wherever you were, and you could work out where on the Earth's surface you were if you knew the time and you knew what you were looking directly up at.
Thankfully, we don't necessarily need to do that anymore. We've all got sat navs and things, which is kind of...
Well, yeah, do you say that in some ways? So that, I think it's still part of a lot of pilots, especially military pilots, that if you need sailors, will be taught how to navigate by the stars. If you get a pilot's license, certain night flying, you will be told about how to navigate. Yeah, if you lost all your instrumentation, how do you know which direction's which? We're none of us are going to be astronauts, but astronauts, they did take reckonings from the stars in order to work out where their spaceships were.
You never know. Maybe somebody listening is thinking they'd love to be an astronaut one day. So we're coming to the end of our conversation today. Why do you think that astronomy is a good hobby that matters now?
And maybe matters even more now than previously. I think it's, we've touched on it a number of times, that wherever you are in the world, the stars are a constant. It's something we can agree on. And I think in a world where it's so difficult to work out if you've been told the truth about something or not the truth about something, just to have something that you know is true, wherever you can speak to, wherever somebody's come from, whichever country, they're pretty much going to know. There's that touchstone of that is a commonly held truth. And I think also it does give us a little bit of a chance to bring our heads away from our tablets and phones and just contemplate, well, if you come along to Norwich Astronomical Society at some point, look through on the big telescopes, look at Jupiter. You may just think that's not for you, you can't relate to it, but most people will look at that and just see another world suspended in the eyepiece, and that will just kind of trigger some questions of, well, what is my place in this bigger universe? So I think that's kind of some of the key why it can be important to people.
And if somebody does want to have a look and find out more, where can they find out about the...
The first place is just type into Google, put your head back into your phone and type in Norwich Astronomical Society. That will come up with our website. There's some contact us pages. So we are also there most Friday nights. So I think pretty much every Friday night we open. There may be some summer nights when we don't, but drop an email in on the website. Just ask if there's going to be somebody there on a Friday night. Just pop along and say hello to us.
Well, I hope that we'll find some new stargazers coming to have a look.
Yeah, indeed.
After hearing this, thank you so much.
Yeah, hope so too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.